Bow hunters are some of the hardest working hunters there are. Most of us work hard all year long just to get a couple weekends or burn our vacation time to sit in a tree. And just like the American blue collar worker, we're trying to balance work, family, faith, and a little time for ourselves in the great outdoors. Now let me introduce you to Trollco Clothing, a brand built by blue collar workers for blue collar workers. Workwear, comfortable tees, hoodies and hats for both men and women, Trollco represents the hardworking American. So whether you're operating heavy equipment, wrenching on engines, or in a factory living that shift life, Trollco has your back, literally. Head to trollco.com/hunting. That's trollco.com/hunting and enter the discount code Empire25 for 25% off of your first order. Trollco, for the hardworking American.
You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable. This episode of the Sportsman's Empire is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. Since 1952, Interstate Batteries has been evoking compassion and a trustworthy spirit into the surrounding communities. Interstate Batteries is a mission-driven company fueled by purpose and guided by their values. If you need help locating a specific battery, stop into your local Interstate Batteries retail store and speak with a battery specialist. They even offer cell phone repairs. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.
Two Good & Co. coffee creamers are made with farm-fresh cream, real milk, and contain 3 grams of sugar per serving. That's 40% less than the 5 grams per serving in leading traditional coffee creamers for a rich, delicious experience. Whether you enjoy your coffee hot, cold, bold, or frothy, Two Good coffee creamers make every sip a good one. Two Good coffee creamers, real goodness in every sip. Find them at your local Kroger in the creamer aisle.
Spring break isn't what it used to be. It's better. This spring, stay 3 nights and get a $50 Best Western gift card. Life's a trip. Make the most of it at Best Western. Visit bestwestern.com for complete terms and conditions.
There's only a few more weeks of deer season left, and all of us know how brutally cold it can be sitting outside. But if you want to stay warm and comfortable while you're waiting for that old bruiser to walk by, you need to get yourself some of the incredible gear from Huntworth. I've been using the Matterhorn bibs and jacket this late season, and holy smokes is this stuff toasty. It's windproof, waterproof, and uses Huntworth's heat boost technology in a thick, cozy Sherpa lining to absorb and reflect your body heat back to your skin. Honestly, most of the time I wear this stuff, I end up leaving the bibs vented to catch a breeze because it's just that warm, which is a problem that I'd much rather have than dangling out of a tree, shivering like crazy while trying to reach for my gun or bow. Go build out your late season kit without breaking the bank at huntworthgear.com or check out the sporting goods section of your local farm and fleet or fleet farm to try it out in person. Another deer season has come and gone, and most of you are probably shifting your focus towards postseason scouting or even turkeys. Regardless of what you're thinking about, whenever you hit the field, you need to have the OnX Hunt app open on your phone. You guys have heard me talk about it all year long, and you know my favorite feature is the tracker tool. It's how I paint a picture of a property, and it's how I got an opportunity at my target buck this fall. I love using it now to color code different trails, whether they're access trails, logging roads, or even deer highways. Aside from my boots, the OnX Hunt app is my most used tool every season. To learn more and get subscribed, go check out onxmaps.com. And if you're focused on ice fishing, go ahead and check out the brand new OnX Fish app, which is only available in Minnesota and Wisconsin, and get some fish for the fryer to get you through the winter. If there's one thing that drives me nuts, it's gear that doesn't work well. I can't stand it when my sticks or my stand make noise, they don't bite into a tree well, or most importantly, don't travel well. Luckily, I haven't had any of those problems with the fantastic gear I've been running from XOP. All this fall, I was hiking in over a mile, and it was a piece of cake because I knew my gear wasn't going to be flopping around, making noise, or a pain once I got to my tree. This season, I used the Ultralight Retrograde stand and the X2 climbing sticks, and I absolutely loved them. To get them in and out, I carried everything in using the Gamma TS transport system, which cinches down to the bottom of your stand and turns your tree stand into a super comfy, lightweight frame pack for all of your gear. If you're looking to build out or tweak your mobile hunting kit, you've got to go check out the awesome products from XOP at xopoutdoors.com. going on, everyone? Welcome back to another episode of the Wisconsin Sportsman Podcast. I'm your host, Pierce Nellis, and this is your home for all things hunting, fishing, and conservation in the Badger State. Folks, I hope you're doing well. Hope you're enjoying the little warm spell we've had here. Recording this still with a full belly after attending the Wild Wisconsin dinner that was put on over at Seven Acre Dairy with Hank Shaw, who we had on a couple weeks ago, telling us all sorts of good stuff about cooking our wild game and how we can do that better. Had a blast there. Got to chat with Hank a little bit more and just enjoyed some awesome food. That's pretty much the only thing new with me. I've been still slammed with work as of right now. Just trying to get all the engineering done here so we can freeze our design and get ready to build our first prototype here. So that's been keeping me pretty darn busy, but been doing a little e-scouting here and there when I can. Haven't really gotten a chance to see the water at all, which I was really itching to do with these 50 degree days we had last week, but oh well, it is what it is. I did get out and shoot my bow, and that's just kind of the topic of today's episode. I got to sit down with Nate Sellers of Average Jack Archery. He's also my contact over at Huntworth, handles all things marketing and media coordination for the Vertec, Tarnin, and Disruption lines over at Huntworth. So I had Nate on to kind of pick his brain about what are some of the things that we should all be doing with our bows right now. How are we going to stay sharp? How can we make sure our gear is in good shape? And what are the things that we really just should be doing if we're the kind of guys who have, after our rutcation, we stashed our bows away for the rest of the year and they're not going to come out until, things warm up again. Or maybe some guys are shooting league right now or doing some indoor shooting and stuff. Or some of us are just sitting at home like me and, we'll get it out when the weather's nice, but it's not really too high on the priority list. But I talked with Nate. I got to pick his brain about what are the things that we should be doing? What kind of maintenance should we be doing on our bows this time of year? What gear upgrades are worth doing? What are some of the, things that are worth tweaking versus not tweaking? And really just all things archery to kick off this off season right here. But an awesome conversation with him. He dropped a ton of knowledge in this one. We got a good chat going about our Huntworth gear as well, which if you have not checked out yet, definitely go do that, because I know all of you listening, at some point this past fall, you were sitting in a tree and you were cold. And I would just hate for you to have to do that again. So you should definitely go get yourself some of the awesome gear from Huntworth and their heat boost line, because that stuff is freaking legit, as you will hear Nate and I talk about in this episode. I think you guys are really going to enjoy this one. I learned a ton from Nate. And before we dive on into the episode, I have a really, really exciting announcement. We have just agreed to a partnership with the Wisconsin chapter of Backcountry Hunters and Anglers. We've had Alec on the show a couple times. We had Brock on earlier. Alec is now the chair of the Wisconsin chapter, so congratulations to him. But we're going to be teaming up this year to keep you guys really, really in the loop in terms of all things going on the BHA front, public policy front, conservation front, and also the events front, all across the state, and all the awesome work that those guys are going to be doing. So we've got plans in the works here. We're going to try and do some quarterly policy updates with Paul, the head of policy over at our chapter of BHA, to keep you guys in the know in terms of what's going on like the legal side of things and what things you should have on your radar. And then of course, like I said, the awesome events that the BHA chapter puts on, all the Learn to Hunt events, the Pint Nights, all that good stuff. You're going to be much more in the know through this show. So be sure to be on the lookout for some awesome collaboration that we have on the horizon here going forward. And of course, if you're not a BHA member already, I would strongly encourage you to join the Wisconsin chapter, whatever state you're listening from, backcountryhunters.org/join. It's an awesome, awesome organization. I'm really, really proud to be partnered with these guys, and I'm looking forward to what kind of stuff we're going to be teaming up on in the future here. So with that, enjoy this episode, folks. Folks, I've got Nate Sellers, who you may know as the owner of Average Jack Archery. He's also the marketing media coordinator for Huntworth. But I've got Nate on the line. We're going to be talking through some postseason bow work and archery practice, drills, all sorts of stuff here. But Nate, how are we doing today?
Doing all right, man. Super happy to be on. I appreciate you giving me the nod, right? You're tapping me into the ring here. So I appreciate it. It's
going
to be a fun time together.
Yeah, man. I mean, we only spent, better part of an hour or so just shooting the breeze prior to hitting record.
It is what it is. I'm actually surprised. You got to hit on a dry this early in the year. You got a dry fly hit already.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yep. Yeah, so like right now, the midges will be hatching. Midges and scuds are the only thing, I guess leeches too, are the only things that are available year-round. But midges hatch, you know, it was a 29-degree day when I was out the other day. And
just
hit that warm mark, and
really? The
temperatures just got to bump up a degree or two. And yeah, fish were rising. It was pretty cool.
That's very interesting. Yeah, I'm not spooky. A big fly fisherman, but I was just going to say, they have to be spookies I'll get out this time of year still. I'm not a big fly fisherman, but I do know enough to get me in trouble. And so the fact that you were getting a hit on a dry this early, here we shoot in January of all times, that's pretty impressive.
Yeah, it's a good time, man. You guys have a pretty neat little, I was getting the Pennsylvania rundown from you here when we were just talking, but you guys have some excellent fly fishing over there, as well as, you know, the elk and the Amish and deer,
we have,
of course.
Some amazing fly fishing out here. Yeah, it's truthfully, like, there are some beautiful waters out here. I think Little Juniata and Pine Creek and Spruce Creek and Spring Creek, and there's a lot of smaller tributaries that feed into those that are just full of native fish. It's Pennsylvania's really an underrated, you know, I know everybody loves to go out west and, you know, it's beautiful. Of course, you can't beat the scenery in that and catching huge rainbows, cutthroat type stuff, but out here catching browns and brookies and the oddball stock rainbow that's held itself over is really some tremendous water in Pennsylvania.
Yeah, definitely, man. I mean, like you said, you've got the mountains over there, you know, all those freestones. I feel like the East as a whole is just kind of an overlooked little gem, because you're right. People think of fly fishing, think of Colorado and Wyoming and Montana and all that sort of stuff. But then you look up some of the, you know, photos and stuff, or even videos of fly fishing and, you know, Pennsylvania, Vermont, New York, stuff like that, like in the Catskills and those freestones.
I was just going to say the Catskills.
Anywhere in the Smokies, Catskills,
the Smokies, the Appalachians. It's just beautiful. It's a different level of beautiful. But yeah, the water for a lot of these streams is just amazing. I mean, it's just crystal clear, cold as ice. It's just amazing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, it's a totally, like you said there, it's a totally different style of fishing. And a different style of beauty with that. You know, you're not going to be catching 20-inch fish, you know, every day. But if you can grow to appreciate the intricacies and the nuance of a really, really skinny sidewalk with, kind of like we have in the Driftless region here, but super narrow creeks and, you know, just gorgeous. I mean, look like they were, you know, bedazzled by your toddler, little brook trout and everything. I mean, it's a very, very unique fishery.
Yeah,
man.
You better get used to barrel casting. If you're going to come up here, you got to get used to barrel cast.
Call it over there?
the barrel roll, barrel cast.
That's funny. I've never heard of barrel casting. I've only heard of
because you're not getting, like a big looping field and stream 80 foot, you know, you're not, it ain't happening up here. You got about 10 feet to work with tops.
Exactly. Yeah, that's kind of what I was doing the other day as well. I found a nice creek with a bunch of canopy over the top of it. I was like, well, I'm not going to cast today, but that's all right. My guides will get frozen anyways. So
yeah, it's true.
As long as I got, you know, 2 feet of fly line and a long leader, I should be okay. But to kick things off here. So I mentioned there, you're the owner of Average Jack Archery, has a phenomenal YouTube channel to go along with the business. And you're also the marketing media coordinator at Huntworth. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself, kind of where you're from and how you got to where you're at now with Average Jack and Huntworth?
Yeah. So my name is Nate Sellers. I was born and raised in central Pennsylvania, kind of bebopped around the country a little bit, but my home has always been in the Northeast, here in the mountains of Nowhereville, Pennsylvania. I was a middle school English teacher for 10 years before I jumped head over heels into the outdoor industry full time. So I'm the marketing media coordinator, the national lead for Huntworth Gear out of Pittsburgh. So right here in my home state. I do work remotely for the company, but I'm down quite a bit and I'm very, very involved with everybody, you know, Wisconsin sportsmen all the way up to television shows and product development and, you know, what does our e-commerce look like from our website, huntworthgear.com or Amazon or whatever it may be. I wear a lot of different hats. But on top of that, I do own Averjack Archery Pro Shopping Range, which is in Phillipsburg, PA. It's not too far from Penn State University. Right now, with the addition of the new range that we just added, it's a little over a 7,000 square foot facility. We carry Matthews, we carry Elite, we carry PSC, Bear, 10-point Wicked Ridge crossbows, and a couple other different odds and ends, all the arrows and releases you could, broadheads you could shake a stick at. So I've been covering the archery industry and teach people how to hunt and shoot a bow since 2014 on YouTube. And so that's kind of how I got this whole thing started. So jumping into my 11th year now of doing media, just got back from the ATA show a couple days ago. And that was my, gosh, seventh or eighth ATA show now, which doesn't sound like a lot when you talk to people at ATA. They've been doing it for 40 years, you know, or whatever. But from a media perspective, it's pretty cool. And so, yeah, a little over 60,000 subscribers on YouTube, which for the hunting industry is pretty solid. And I self-film all of my hunts and travel all over the country doing stuff for Huntworth and for archery and for YouTube. So that's kind of my background with it. And yeah, the shop is by far, I think, the most fun, you know, in terms of just it's always been a passion and a dream of mine. I compete both indoors and outdoors in 3D. With archery. So it's not just bow hunting for me. It's the competition side that keeps me going year round.
That's awesome, man. So what came first? Was it the YouTube page or the bow shop?
Oh, definitely YouTube. Yeah. So the bow shop's only been open up for about three. Yeah. The bow shop's only been open up for about 3 years now. We opened up in 2022. So we had 2022, 2023, 2024. So now this is 2025 to be our fourth fiscal year anyway. And it does really well. Central Pennsylvania is a very rural place. If we didn't have Penn State University, the central part of the state would look very different. And I'm an hour away from it. So I'm not like I'm terribly far, but it feels like you could be an eternity. And so the central part of the state is a lot of bow hunting. It's a lot of bow hunting heritage, but it does not have a lot of shops. And particularly in this past 5 to 10 years, a lot of, you know, retired, gone out of business. And so there's just been a void. And on top of that, even if you did open up a shop, it's very difficult to, you know, have a very high functioning shop, understand how to work on bows, how to understand how to work with customers, you know, how to handle customer complaints, how to handle customer needs. And so as somebody who's worked in sales and marketing and teaching middle school English, I've worked with children, disgruntled ones in particular in middle school my entire life. It was something I was able to kind of open up and get going pretty quickly. So the first year was great and it's only gone better from there. And I hope to keep doing it for many, many more years to come.
That's awesome, man. That's such a cool story. And, you know, just, I don't know, filling the gap, being able to open up doors, you know, kind of fueling a passion of yours is it's really, really cool. And you know, the we were talking before we recorded here, but you wear a lot of hats on a given day.
Oh, yeah.
And you're kind of running two full-time gigs through this, and you have your hands full, but seeing you balance it all and handle everything and, you know, get to work in the hunting industry on top of it all is it's pretty darn cool, man.
Yeah, my work-life balance is definitely in the toilet. It's not great, but, you know, it's cool. You know, I have two beautiful young girls, my beautiful wife, and, you know, it's we definitely have our fun together as a family still, but it is taxing. You know, it's two full-time jobs. You know, you can't be a business owner and do it part-time. That's not how that works.
Yeah.
Heck, you know yourself, you know, running a podcast and startups and everything else. It's not... There's never a day of autopilot. You know, you're always doing something.
Yep.
And so it definitely is an interesting balance, but I wouldn't know what to do if I wasn't working. I'm not necessarily a workaholic, but I just can't sit still. If I'm sitting still, it just feels like I'm wasting an opportunity to be doing something better. So
Yeah, totally. Just busy. That's all. It's
just busy.
Not a workaholic.
Whether, you know, you're whether just it's busy. Shooting I'm shooting my bow to get better for tournaments, or I'm trying to learn a new way to do this, or, you know, what is going to be the best, you know, doing research on what might be a good product to bring into the shop, whatever it is, like there's always something I could be doing that could, you know, better my career, better my future, better the dollars made at the shop, whatever it may be. Because I feel like just being complacent, I had that. I had that feeling of being complacent when I was in education. And it drove me nuts. It drove me absolutely bonkers. And I can't stand to have that feeling. And so I can't stand to just sit by the side and just let things unfold. I like being proactive. And if that means I'm busy, it means I'm busy.
Right. Absolutely. Well, I would imagine too, just the way you said that, can't stand being kind of like kept in a box or, you know, in an area where you don't have a lot of, I guess, lateral options or anything like that. Basically, where you just can't move, you can't do stuff. I would imagine that's probably reflected in your hunting style as well. I know you've got, you said you've got, what, 8,000 acres of public land out your back door? I know you're a mobile hunter as well. So I'd imagine that kind of factors into chasing all sorts of critters around those hills.
Yeah, no tree is safe. I actually just got done telling a customer yesterday. He's like, you ever hunt from the ground? I said, no, but if there's a tree about 4 inches in diameter that's shaped like a Twizzler, I'll climb it. It doesn't bother me at all. And it's true. I mean, it really does lend itself to not being complacent. It comes to bite you in the rear end every now and then, being too mobile, you know, being too proactive in the woods. But nowadays in particular, the past like 7-8 years when I've really become really, really highly mobile has really done wonders for my sightings on deer, but also getting closer to deer. I'll talk to guys all the time. It's like, I'm going to put my tree here so that way I have a 30-yard shot this way and a 40-yard shot that way. And I'm sitting there thinking, I would much rather just pick one of them and have that thing at 10 yards. Right. And I can do that now. You know, I can climb any tree. I hunt with a saddle. I hunt with a tethered ultralock. And I one stick from time to time, or I'll use multiple sticks. And if I need to be in a tree that's 10 yards off the trail and I got one shooting lane, but that's the best thing, I'm doing it because that's going to be where I need to sit. And I never would have thought like that in the past. And it was shown, you know, I was making marginal shots on animals. I was passing up shots on animals because I didn't feel comfortable with the distance. But now it's such a breath of fresh air. All right, well, I know I'm 60 yards away from that trail. I'm not whacking him. So if I see him, it's beautiful. I'll film him. But if he comes over on this 10-yarder, it's going right into pump house. He's done. It's over. And so
totally.
Yeah, being mobile has helped a lot. Having a little bit of ADHD has helped a lot, I should say.
There's a time and a place for it, for sure. No, I like that a lot. And I found myself sort of, I don't know. When the moment counted, I found myself trying to maximize trails, like you said, when I should have just picked the closer of the two and, you know, ended up missing the target buck I was after this last year. But I feel like that's something that a lot of guys struggle with, you know, especially as they're getting into the mobile game and kind of trying to figure out their own hunting strategy, really, because it's so easy to be like, well, there's a trail here, and especially on public land, right? You like when there's a little bit more guesswork if you haven't, you know, done your scouting or anything, and there could be two trails that are, they look like cattle paths that are 50 yards from each other. It's like, okay, well, I don't know, like, which trail should I be able to shoot? But, you know, like you said, being able to lock in on just one and commit to it is, I don't know, I think it leads one to stay a little more sharp. And like you said, leads to less error, less missed shots, less wounded animals and stuff like that.
Just top to bottom. Absolutely.
Totally, man. So you just got back from the ATA show. How was that for you this year?
ATA was all right. I think if you talk to anybody that attends ATA and has attended ATA, you know, like I said, probably in the same time window that I've been there. So the past like 7-8 years, if you attend it, you're like, okay, this doesn't feel like it's as big as it could be. And if you ask anybody that's been doing it 15, 20, 30 years, they would tell you that exact same thing. So it is unfortunate that it is definitely on the backside of 40. It's well over the hill. As a shop owner, I get the perspective of, you know, ATA used to be the place where everybody unveiled a new product. Everybody had to go. All the dealers, as many dealers from around the country would go. And what ATA is supposed to be used for, a lot of people still don't understand what ATA is, it's that it's a trade show, which means that your dealers of those products that are in your retail stores are going to see those products firsthand. And then every booth that you're in that you probably don't see on camera, every booth you're in has tables and chairs, and most of the reps that represent that company are there as well. And you go to the booth, you play with the new product, you get it checked out, and then you and your rep, who's hopefully there, sit down at a table and you write out an order for the year. And you say, okay, let's just take, I'll say Big Shot Targets, for example. Big Shot Targets, I went there. Proud Big Shot dealer. They're out here out of PA. And they're like, okay, if you buy right now at the show, we'll give you this pricing. It's really good pricing. But if you buy from us in like 3 weeks, that pricing goes away and it's back to normal pricing. And I lose, you know, and I don't make as much money when I sell that product. That's the point of ATA. Mm-hmm. You go and you say, all right, on March 1st, I want this, I want 10 targets shipped or whatever. And on June 1st, I want this many targets. And on August, so that way you space out your orders. But at the end of the day, that company knows, all right, Nate's buying 40 targets or 100 targets or 10,000 targets. We need to make 10,000 targets for Nate right now, mm-hmm. because we know he's going to want them. So the whole purpose for the ATA show is that we, manufacturers and dealers, are all on the same page. And everybody can go yep. order what they need at the best pricing of the year. The manufacturers are happy and the retailers are happy. Then COVID hit and we couldn't meet in person. So the archery industry mm-hmm. found a way, not shockingly, to do it digitally. And now here is your digital order writer. You're doing the exact same thing. You're just not sitting across the table from somebody. And so now dealers, all even before ATA, are pretty much getting all of the paperwork that we need to place those orders before ATA even happens. So what's the point mm-hmm. of going to ATA anymore? The special pricing is offered digitally. The orders are all there digitally. You can reach your rep, call, email, text, whatever, depending on the rep. And you can get all your orders in on your time, on your dime. And so the ATA show has been gutted from the perspective of a lot of stuff is getting launched earlier and earlier and earlier. All the bow companies launch October, November anymore. So they don't even have a new bow to show off at the ATA show in January. Yep. And dealers have paperwork. So ATA used to be this big thing. You had to be there. If you weren't there, you were missing out on all this great opportunity and to see the new products. And when I was going and filming the ATA, that was a big thing because that was the first time you at home got to see that new product, right? And everybody, I would do it too. ATA show. You know, new videos on YouTube, and you're looking, you're waiting, what's the new fresh stuff? And that's how you got it. Well, nowadays, everybody mm-hmm. and their brother has Instagram. You know, so such and such makes a new kickstand, makes a new broadhead, snaps a picture, posts it up on their own personal page. I don't even have to be there to make media coverage anymore. So it's been gutted in a lot of different ways. The show is still fun. It's great to see a lot of cool faces and see a lot of people I only get to see one or two times a year. You know, if I don't see him on the tournament trail, I get to see him at ATA. But even then, mm-hmm. Is it worth the investment for the hotels and the food and the travel and everything else just to see old friends? To an extent, yeah.
Sure.
There are lots of cool people I get to see, but yeah, it's unfortunate it's not what it used to be.
Yeah, no, that makes sense, man. And that, you know, it seems like over the past few years, you know, since I've kind of been following along with it a little bit more closely, it seems like it's kind of turned into more of a content grab, for lack of a better term, you know, and kind of like you said, you know, guys run around with cameras trying to see how many photos or, you know, quick reels they can make of new products and stuff like that that have been, you know, released around the market. And I'm sure there's still a couple products that come out, you know, for like just at the ATA show, but it seems like it's a lot more of a content and networking opportunity than it was for an actual, you know, transactional side of things. It's like they turned it into like Black Friday. You know how this year it was like Black Friday lasted 3 months before Black Friday and another 2 weeks after or something, or like 3 weeks, I should say, not 3 months, but you know, it was a whole 6 week ordeal, it felt like, leading up mm-hmm. to the holidays this year, whereas it used to just mm-hmm. be like your deals are only Black Friday, but now it's like, oh, here's early Black Friday stuff, here's early, like, whatever, let's just get this taken care of. That's interesting, man. That's really interesting. Were there any things at the show that, you know, you did really enjoy, or that you like any new products or anything that got you excited?
You know, it's funny. I always get asked that. I always like, oh, what's new at the show? And it used to be there was lots of new stuff at the show that no one knew about yet. And I think the only thing that I filmed that was new at the show that no one has seen yet was the new Bowtech Virtue, the new, you know, magnesium alloy rare earth metal riser bow that they're making. They specifically launched that at ATA. The other one was the Hotshot Ignition release, which I've been using and keeping behind the scenes for like months now. And now I finally got the final, you know, in production version. Those were kind of the two big reveals that happened there. But outside of that, you know, the companies might have been existing. People not knew about the companies yet. There's a lot of smaller broadhead companies there that I filmed. But most of the stuff was things we've seen before. You know, I always go and film, you know, Mike Somm of Magnus Broadheads, you know, my favorite broadheads of all time. And he's there and he had a new product last year with a single bevel, but he didn't have a new product this year, but he's still there. You know, that was most of the companies. They don't have anything really new. Maybe they tweaked a thing here and there, but they're there at the show anyway, because that's what they've been doing for 20, 30, 40 years. So, yeah, I think the Virtue Bow is really cool. That was a really light and a new product. Really like that release from Hotshot. I shot 320. I took the production release, tinkered with it, brought it home, shot 326X on a Vegas face the very next day with it. So yeah, definitely those products were cool. But outside of that, it was kind of, I don't want to say ho-hum because I'm not making the products, right? I didn't invest countless hours of R&D work and stuff, but it was pretty average, I would say.
Gotcha. You know, as a bow shop owner, you know, and I mean, extremely high level archer as you are, I got to ask, every year we see all of our favorite brands come out with new, you know, the latest and greatest bow, right? The flagships, they all come out, you know, all this stuff, you know, there's new technology, new tweaks and stuff like that. In your experience, like over the past 10 years, or even like on a year to year basis, let's keep it year to year. How much better are the bows that come out every single year, like the new ones? Like how much better is the technology that we're seeing on a year to year basis? Is it the kind of thing where it's like, okay, I bought a bow in 2021, it's 2025 now. Like, is my 2021 bow old news? Or how much better is this, you know, 3-year-old, 4-year-old newer bow?
Yeah. So that is it seems the like we're splitting hairs. Question. It's the age old. So here's the issue when people ask this, and this is true about any product from any manufacturer. Mm-hmm. It's not what we have to start now in 2025 and going forward, even 2024 and going forward. What we have to have the mentality shift of is this better than last year's thing? Okay, we need to stop that and we go, is this better? Okay, or is this a different take or a different angle on something they've done in years past? Not just last year, but in years past. I'll use Matthews as an example. Matthews had the V3 in 2021, whatever it was. Okay, they made a V3 27.5, really short bow, and a V3 31. Matthews had not made a 28-inch or shorter bow since the Tri-Ax about 4 years prior. So what I'm saying is, instead of going, was this V3 27, is it better than the bow that they made the year before? Or is it better than the product they made 4 years ago? That's the mentality I want people to have. And the answer is yes. That V3 27 was better than the Tri. It balanced better. It was smoother draw. It had less vibration and it was quieter than the bow that it was trying to compete against 4 years in the past. Same thing with the Phase 4. The Phase 4 from Matthews was 2 years ago. Yeah, 2023. Is that right? Yeah, 2023. Mm-hmm. 2023. Is that better than the last ultra quiet 33-inch axle-to-axle bow they had made? Yes, it was. Now, was it better than the bow that came out the very year before it? That's up to you. But the bow that it was trying to compete against from like 3-4 years ago, is it better than that one? Absolutely. Draw cycle was phenomenal. It was stupid quiet. The Lift came out then last year. The Lift is not the Phase 4. Totally different cam. It's built for speed. People are like, oh, Matthews took a step backwards. And I'm not a Matthews guy. I'm an Elite guy. I love their bows. But Matthews did not make a bow that was the same as the bow before it. It was a speed bow. It's just specifically designed to be quick, and it's designed to be light. So what we need to do is look, what was the last light, quick bow that Matthews made? And compare it against that one. And is it better than that one? Absolutely. The last light quick bow Matthews made was like, oh gosh, 2018, somewhere in, 2017. Okay. Maybe it would have been like the Z3, the Z7. Super light, fast for its day. Is the lift better than that bow? By a country mile and then some. So that's what I tell people to look at is don't look at every year against itself. Look at what is this thing versus what it would have competed against from that company 3 or 4 years ago. Because the same thing's true of every, it's mostly the bow companies. Everybody loves the Harpon, right? Oh, it's another $1,300 paperweight or whatever. But really think about it is if you had its comparable bow, you know, 3 or 4 years ago, is it better than that one? And the answer is always yes. 100% right now, it's still always yes. Year over year, you won't see the change. It'll be this bow was made to compete against something. Because they don't, people don't understand that when something is getting made, it takes 3-4 years. Like if you ask, like, I'm very good friends with Mike Somm over at Magnus Broadheads. When they made the Black Hornet, which is the exact same style of every head they currently make, how long it took them to develop that head? It took like 3 years to develop that head. It's a main blade with a bleeder. How does it take you 3 years? You're making the same broadhead. It took 3 years. So when that was designed, when that was being designed while something else was being launched. So then 3 years later, was that design that they were working on better than that thing they launched 3 years ago? Absolutely it was. So, but now, you know, there's always something in the hopper that's going to come out a few years later. It's a couple years down the road.
Okay.
And when that comes out, is it better than what was happening when that last thing was created or whatever? If you just try to go year over year, it's just, you're exactly right. It looks exactly the same. But if you compare it to what it would have been compared to the last time they made something similar, is it going to be better? The answer is always yes.
Got it, dude. That makes so much more sense. Cause here I should have prefaced this conversation. Like when it comes to archery and like bow tuning, archery work, all that sort of stuff, like, dude, I'm a freaking Neanderthal. Like I don't know archery specs, bow specs, like the nuts and bolts behind it. I know very, very surface level information about my bow and my setup and all that sort of stuff. But you know, for like that's so good to know that. You know, the example, like you said, like the Z3 or the Z7 or whatever it was, you know, knowing that like they launched that bow and then immediately for the next 4 years, they were trying to, or however many years they were trying to, okay, we're going to reiterate and we're going to relaunch this line in so many years. And that's how they kind of like operate that. Cause it makes sense then from, you know, thinking kind of behind the scenes as from the business side of things, have a couple different, you know, lines that are sort of just always circulating. So you've always got a new thing to come out every year versus just here's our one model and we're going to build off of this for years to come and make minor tweaks and all that.
Yeah,
I feel like so many people view it as that because that's all they see.
You can't do that. Yeah. So Elite this year is a great example. Elite Bows is a great, they made the Artist for 2025. It is the first like 30 inch axle to axle bow that Elite has made in like 6 years. But again, they're like, oh, is it so much better than last year's bow? Maybe. Is it better than the last 30-inch bow they made 6 years ago? Absolutely. It blows its doors off. It's not even close. But that's not how people view it. They go, well, year over year, are we really getting better? Are we really getting better speeds? You compare its speed to 6 years ago. Yeah. You compare the technology, you know, the integration that's on it, the set technologies, you know, Bowtex Deadlock, all these things. If you go back and see again, what was, you know, again, they don't just etch and sketch, shake it, and then start from scratch. Like there's stuff in the hopper. There's stuff in the hopper, right? And they might find out that this cam works better with this riser length and this limb angle and this geometry. It's not just trying to regurgitate the same thing. But you will notice that, you know, there are certain times where people, Matthews is a prime example of it, when they came out with the Phase 4, they did the little, you know, teeny four limb thing. But they stuck with the same cam that they had in the years past. It was obvious that bow was like a little stepping stool for them to try something before they went full-fledged with the whole brand new product. And that's what they did. The right. next year, they came with a whole new cam, whole new module, whole new limb system. But you could tell that that phase four is kind of, so that was an incremental step, right? And sometimes they'll mm-hmm. do that. Sometimes they won't just overhaul it. But you got to, the only way to know if something's going to work in the hands of bow hunters is by selling it and putting it in the hands of bow hunters. And so you can't, yeah. you got to keep some things consistent. You can't just totally overhaul the whole product, because what if it's a turd and no one buys mm-hmm. it? Now what? You know, now you don't have any data. You don't have any data. You don't have any sales. You don't know if it went well, if it went poorly, if the bow's holding up, the bow's going to snap in half. So there's just, you got to be careful. It's a constant catch 22. So I tell people all the time, totally. Don't compare it to what you saw last year. Compare it to what this would compare to in size, axle, brace height, speed, to however many years mm-hmm. ago to the last mid-depth bow.
Yeah, got it. That's super good to know, man. Because I, you know, this time, I guess not this time, last year, like 6 months ago or so, I bought a new bow after toting around a very old Mission Riot for 10 years. I upgraded to a PSE Evo XF33 that was hanging on my local shop's wall for 3 years, and they just couldn't sell the dang left-handed bow because nobody was buying them. So I got lucky there. But dude, going through eBay, the Lancaster Archery, like bow reviews, like bowhunting.com, like forum, or like a, you know, review process and stuff, archery forums, like all sorts of stuff, trying to figure out like, okay, like I just found this bow. The price looks good. It looks like it's in good shape, but like, I don't know what to compare this thing to. And I know that anything I buy is going to be better than what I currently have. And so, man, the amount of information out there for somebody like me who doesn't know a whole lot was like a little overwhelming. So knowing that that's how you should actually be, I guess, evaluating the different bows, is comparing them, not necessarily to the past years, but to the previous version of that from that company.
Correct.
Whether that be yeah. 1 year or 5 years old. That's really, really interesting, man. That's yeah. super good to know.
10 years ago, that wasn't the case. 10 years ago, mm-hmm. bows really were better every single year. But then around 2020, right. around 2020, it was just kind of like, you know, year over year, it's incremental changes. But again, mm-hmm. there's only so much we can do to a bow. But again, it's comparing it to, so in 10 years from now, when we do this exact same exercise, and we go back and look and say, okay, it's now 2035, is a bow in 2030 better or worse than a bow in 2035? I don't know. We'll see when we get there. But, you know, will this same exercise hold true? Because if you look at where we started, 1976, when compounds came legal to hunt with in Pennsylvania, to 2000, that 25-year span, holy smokes. And then you look from 2000 right. to 2025. Again, holy smokes. Will we have that same holy smokes reaction from 2025 to 2050? I don't know. Time will tell. Mm-hmm. But for now, that's the yeah. that's the way I tell people to manage it, because it still rings true.
That's so smart, man. And I mean, like that book you were showing me earlier, you know, the circular cams from 2004 or something like that compared to the cams that we have now. It's a whole nother world, man.
Yeah.
I want to switch gears here a little bit towards kind of like the DIY thing, I guess DIY archery, maintenance and updates and tweaks and shooting and all that sort of stuff. We're at a point in the year now where, like, man, I'm still feeling just in my body and my back and my knees and stuff right now, just the repercussions of packing the miles on this past year. I know that our bows also tend to take a beating through the course of an archery season. What should folks be doing right now to make sure that things are still in good shape with their bow? Because I feel like we're at this tipping point where it's like either guys are doing indoor league and they're going to be doing a bunch of shooting, they're in the shop and they're going to do a ton of tinkering, or they've taken their bow and it is in the case and we will see it in August. So what should guys be doing right now if they are in any of those scenarios, just to check out their bow, get it in their hand? Like what is the... I don't know, the bow physical that you would recommend folks go through?
Yeah. So 80% to 90% are that third group. The bow is in the case and they'll see it again in July. That's mm-hmm. where they're at. And that group is the largest and also the most in dire need of not doing that. Group one and two were Shootin' League. The Shootin' League guys are the smartest dudes on planet Earth. I'm not saying they're the most accurate dudes on planet Earth. They are the smartest guys on planet Earth. I'm being serious, right? And I say that with much love because our league is going on right now. Our league's going on right now. Mm-hmm. And the number one thing, this is true of anything, right? If you hang out with mechanics all the time, you're going to start to pick up things about cars. You hang out with computer technicians all the time, you're going to start to learn things about computers. You hang out with cooks, you're going to start to learn how to chef, right? If you hang out with a bow technician or you hang out in a local shop or you hang out with other archers, you're going to start picking up things about your bow that you didn't know to look for. Okay. So every year I get asked this question, what should I do? Should I oil my bow? Should I wipe down my bow? I said, come shoot leagues. Come shoot leagues because two things are going to happen. One, you're going to walk past my bench and say, hey, how does my bow look? And to a trained eyeball, I can be able to tell you. You might need new strings. You might need just a good waxing. Maybe you got some peep twist I can help fix, whatever it may be. Secondly, then you're going to go into the range. You're going to be shooting with 5, 6, 10 other guys and gals, and you're going to be looking at their bow. And you're going to go, oh, his bow has this and mine doesn't. What's up with that? Why does his string look like this? Mine looks like this. Why does his peep have a tube and mine doesn't? You know, you're going to start wondering things and asking questions. And then you're going to come back to the shop owner or the guy behind the counter, and then you're going to ask these things. You're going to want to look for these things. You're going to learn. You're going to get educated more. And so you'll start to understand, what does a good string look like? What does a bad string look like? What is one that just needs waxed? Is my bow feeling out of time? You don't learn that until you're actually kind of taught it, either organically or explicitly. So the guys that are shooting leagues right now, if they have a bowstring that's been shot, and when I say be it's shot, is shot, like it's just done, it's over, this is the best time of year to get a string cable change. Right now, dead of winter, because shops right now are just doing the indoor thing, or maybe selling a bow here and there, but it is dead. Once May, June, July hits, we start ramping up. We start ramping up quick. And it's, and at least in my store, it's not a labor thing. Like, I can keep up on labor. It's the string builders. Because they got to make your string. They got to make it to spec. They got to put it in the colors that you want. That's 2, 3, 4 weeks, depending on how busy somebody, a manufacturer is. We sell a lot of gas bowstrings. Phenomenal bowstrings, but their lead time, because their quality is so good, is high. So if you come to me in July and it's like, hey, I'd like this done next week, I'm going to look at you and say, tough turkey lips. You come to me in January, dude, you'll have it like February 1st. Like, it's not that big of a deal. So the best thing to do right now is just take, if you think you need something, take it down to your shop right now and have a well-trained eye look at it. If you don't know what you're looking at, just have somebody who does this for a living look at your bow. And I know there's a lot of animosity towards local bow shops, and they're always trying to upsell and all sort of thing. I would rather have somebody try to upsell me something than sit at home and wonder if it's going to snap, right? Is it in bad shape? Mm-hmm. If it doesn't look all scuffed up and roughed up, give it a good coat of wax, rub it in, and you're fine. But the more you shoot your bow is just like the more you drive your car. If you drive your car all the time and you hear a sound that doesn't sound like normal in your daily driver, then you know that's something that needs fixed. If you shoot your bow all the time and something's weird, you'll know. But if you put the bow away and don't pick it up for another 6 months, 5 months, you won't remember. You won't remember if it feels right, if it sounds weird. So the more you're able to shoot, A, you just build your accuracy and back muscles the entire year, and your confidence in your shooting the entire year. And it supports your local shop. And it gives you the opportunity to always know what your bow is supposed to feel and sound like. I mean, it amazes me. Guys will come in and be like, I thought I had arrows. What do you mean you thought you had arrows, man? It's like September 15th. What do you mean you thought you had arrows? He's like, I just opened my case. It's September 15th. I don't have arrows. I need arrows. I'm like, holy smokes, man. Those guys happen every year, and they'll continue to happen. But it is my life goal to try to make that population smaller and smaller every single year. Mm-hmm. So that's the biggest maintenance tip, is going and shooting your bow. Yeah. That's really it. Put wax here and lube this and wipe this down. Heck with all that. Go shoot it. You'll learn. Just like driving your car.
Sure. Sure. What is, on that note though, what is the most common issue that you see bows, with bows after a hunting season, after guys have been toting them in and out of their trucks and into the woods and all that sort of stuff? Like what's the most common things that you see?
Most common things is guys leave stuff in there that damages strings. So, lot of guys will ride an e-bike or an ATV and it'll get covered in dust and mud. And, you know, we all know that, you know, like saddle hunters, right? Or, you know, tree stand guys, we all know that dirt and grit and rocks and stuff is the prime killer of ropes. You know, it gets in the sheathing and it breaks down the fibers. But with their bowstrings, you're like, yeah, whatever. No, take that thing home. Just wipe it off. You don't have to do anything. You don't need to put it in a press and pull out Q-tips. I've done that too, you know, when I'm really retentive about it. But most of the time, just take a good terry cloth and just wipe everything down. Make sure it's cleaned off. Wax your string. If you've gotten yourself in moisture or in a dirty situation, wipe everything off and give your string cables a good waxing. Never once, and I tell this every single week in my shop, never once has anybody come into my store and be like, man, I think I waxed my string too much. No one has ever said that. They all come in and be like, yeah, I really should wax it. Or yeah, I wax it every now and then. Never do they come in and say I wax it too much. So it's really hard to overwax a string, right? It's really easy to neglect it. And so if you want to extend the life of your car's engine, is you want to make sure the oil's in good shape. And the oil of a bow is its strings. And so if you maintain the strings, you do proper oil changes in air quotes there by getting new strings and cables every 3 to 4 or 5 years, if you don't shoot that much, the life of your bow goes forever. I mean, it's really hard to, from a reputable company, it's really hard to have a bow that breaks down. But if you neglect the string cables, you let them go bad, it's not a good situation for you.
Got it. That's fascinating that you say that, because I feel like I've read at least 3 or 4 articles or posts about why you shouldn't overwax your bowstrings and why most guys are overwaxing. But that's very interesting to hear that the majority of people are underwaxing, actually.
The overwaxing thing, what it really comes down to is every string and cable has serving. And as I described, if you take your thumbnail on, if you don't know what the serving part is, and you rub your thumbnail up again, it sounds like if you rub your thumb up and down a guitar string. That sound. If you hear that sound, that's serving. Or it's a different color than the strings and cables. If you overwax, a lot of time guys will take all that extra wax and they'll be shoving it into the serving. But what they don't know is that a bowstring is not held together with knots. A bowstring and cables are held together with friction. So that string is made with just loops of material. And then at the ends, that serving grips it like a boa constrictor. And the tag ends are underneath. It's about an 8 to a 10 inch tag end. And it's literally being held under there under multiple hundred pounds of pressure under serving. As soon as you wax it and you start rubbing wax all through your serving, that serving becomes slippery and it starts to lose its grip. And now your tag end starts to slip. And now your strings start to creep and they start to stretch and everything's and your serving starts to separate. Now everything starts to break down prematurely. That's where overwaxing comes in, is when people start putting wax into the serving, either on the string or on the cables, and stuff starts to slip. Yeah, that's really where it comes from. There was a big fad, and it still kind of exists, for the waxless material. So BCY and Gas make like the Freak Show strings, Jesse Broadwater's Freak Show strings, or the Ghost XV strings, where they take all the wax out. They strip all the fibers of the wax, because when wax gets squished out, it causes the string to twist a little bit. You'll get peak twist and oh my gosh, it takes like 3 seconds at a reputable bow shop to fix it. Calm down. But they strip all the wax out, which means it's dry. It's just a dry material. Well, what happens with dry materials? Dry materials absorb moisture. And what does the moisture cause? Swelling. And swelling causes things to do this in and out. And so now you'll go from a really wet string to a really dry string based on humidity. So now humidity in the air is playing a factor on your strings and cables. Well, I would much rather have a little bit of extra wax in there than have to know if the barometric pressure of the day is going to throw my peep off. It's all well and good if you're shooting indoors. Fine. Climate control. But I'm not taking that out in the woods. It could be 10 degrees one day and 80 the next. I'm not dealing with that. So yeah, I personally think the waxless fad is exactly that. It's a fad. And that's why you still see the vast majority of strings are sold with what's called 452X from BCY, which is a waxed material. It is by far the number one selling string material. And I think it'll stay that way for the rest of its life.
Got it. That's fascinating, man. So really, that's what folks who are just taking their bow and throwing it in their case for the next 7 months, that's kind of the risk that they're running, is that that string is going to be exposed to, you know, hopefully it's in a house, but say you're somebody who stores your bow in the box in it, like in your garage or something like that, or it's hanging in your basement, whatever it may be, like somewhere that you've got temperature fluctuation, humidity fluctuation. So that's really the impact, is that it's going to wear out your string quicker and shorten the life. That's
exactly right. That is 100% correct. That is, it's literally, and inside of a bow case is worse, because guys will take a bow. This is the worst case scenario. Never take a bow directly from the woods and put it in your case. Never. Take it in the house, hang it up somewhere, let it climatize, and let all the moisture that's on it evaporate. If you take it from the cold woods and put it right in your bow case, and then put that bow case under your bed or in your closet or whatever, now that cold, all that cold steel is now condensing all the moisture of the air inside your bow case, and it doesn't have anywhere to go. And so when guys open up their bow case 6 months later and all their bolts are rusty and the screws are this and everything looks terrible, like, what happened? I didn't get rained on. You didn't have to. You took a cold bow, put it in a warm bow case and hit it, and it wasn't allowed to breathe. And that's every time I see a bow that's just covered in rust, I always ask guy, where is this store? They say in a bow case under my bed. Okay, I know exactly what they do with it. They go right from the cold truck right to the case, right under the bed. And then it sits there, and all that rust on there just eats it alive. Yeah. So imagine what it's doing to the strings.
No way.
Yeah. Imagine what it's doing to your strings. It's sitting under there, cold, damp, wet conditions. And now you've got stuff oxidizing in there. I mean, imagine what the fibers of your string or what your serving's doing. It's a nightmare. So, yeah, that's why I tell guys, let it climatize, let it warm up. You don't have to stick it over a fire. Just bring it into the house. Let it sit there for a few hours. Mm-hmm. And then make sure your case is open too. Like if you store your case in the truck, make sure it's open. Make sure it's climatizing. And then you can put everything together and store it. And then you can store it for, if you don't really want to shoot, you can store it for long periods of time.
Gotcha. Okay. So let me ask you this then. I'm sitting here thinking about this past fall. I am notorious for, I keep my bow case in the back seat of my car and all my gear's in the trunk. And after every hunt, I grab my bow, take the quiver off, I set it in the case, close the lid. Is that going to be an issue for me throughout the season? Like, is that an issue?
Are you noticing any rust right now?
Not that wasn't already there. There's only rust on my site. Okay, gotcha. Yeah, I just wasn't sure.
Okay.
Like, you get in the car and then, you know, you turn the heat on while you're driving home. If that then is going to start creating condensation inside that that case, and then you park your car outside, and then it all gets frosty and cold.
So are you leaving it in the car in the driveway?
Yes. Yes.
Interesting. So the only thing would be probably if you had a long enough drive to warm everything up inside the case and outside the case, that you had a long enough drive that it would start to warm everything up, and then the bow would start to warm up. If the bow stays cold and the air around it is cold, nothing happens, right? So if you have like a 15-minute drive, 20-minute drive, 30-minute drive even, whatever, the case is still cold on the inside, so you're okay. But then also the very next day, 2 days later, you're opening up the case, pulling the bow out. So like at that point, then you're introducing new air, new different moisture, whatever. It's when you store it for long periods of time, or you store it for long periods of time, even worse, in your basement, in your garage, where the humidity and climate control is just not there. So that's why all my bows are kept in my basement, but they're not in cases. They're all hanging up. So they can breathe, quote unquote, they can breathe with as the basement breathes.
Okay. No, that makes a ton of sense. While we're on the topic here, then, for guys, when they're going in and out of the woods with their bow, is there anything that guys should make sure not to do? Like while they're carrying their bow in and out of the tree, while they're hoisting it up and, you know, up and down from their stand, is there any big no-nos that guys should be making sure that they do? Like I've heard some guys talk about, like, never carry your bow by the string because it, you know, twists it or it stretches it out or something like that. Like, is there anything along those lines, or only hoist it by this? Or
yeah, it's funny that you say that about I carry it explicitly by the string. You know, and I've been doing that for 20 years. No, what you'll find is that twist it, you know, by the string, guys are worried that they might like snag it on something, pop it out of the cam, which is, that's a real fear, but you got to be reefing on the thing to get it to pop off the cam if you're dragging along. No, I've been carrying my bow for 20 years by the string. I just don't like holding a cold aluminum riser when it's 20 degrees outside. So I just carry it by a string. Just feels better. So, yeah. So, I mean, you could do anything in that regard that you want. Pulling it up, I always used to do the carabiner and clip it into the cam. Always used to do that. But I've heard and seen now with the shop, seen and heard so many horror stories. The carabiner's breaking. All the noise it makes, clipping it in and out of the cam or something like that. So what I started doing just only a few years ago was, instead of a carabiner, I just have a, I have a retractable gear hoist. It's just paracord. And I made just a loop. I don't know, maybe like a 3-inch loop, you know, in the end of the, you know, with the figure eight at the end of the cord. And I run that loop through a hole in the cam, and then I loop that end around my stabilizer. So I'm picking the bow from the bottom up, but since it's looped through the cam and then to my stabilizer, it actually picks the bow straight up every single time. It can't not, because its point of contact is the cam, but it's looped around the front of the stabilizer. There's no metal. There's no nothing. The weights on the end of the stabilizer keep it from sliding off. And when I'm done, I just pull the bow up, unloop the thing off the stabilizer, let go of the rope, and it just unwinds itself through my cam. Metal free. It's completely quiet. But then it also allows me then, if I I carry a gear hoist hook, a Scorpion gear hook from Tethered. And since I have that loop in there, I just loop it through the eyelet. And if I drop my hat or my release or something, I can just lower that hook down, pull it up, unloop everything, and I'm right back to square one. So yeah, I went away from the metal and the carabiner just for the sake of it breaking or making noise. But yeah, the carrying it by the string, I've done that for years and years and years. The biggest thing is, guys that carry them in backpacks, they don't realize that, like, a webbing buckle edge, like take a piece of 1-inch webbing and just rub it against your skin for like 30 seconds, just the edge of it, and tell me if it hurts.
Yeah.
The answer is yes, it does. It's not comfortable. So imagine doing that for an hour as you hike out of the woods on your bowstring. Really got to be careful. Guys who love, it's become very popular for guys to lash their bow to their backpack. But if you're going to do that, I really recommend one of those neoprene cam and string covers, because those webbing buckles will shred a set of strings, and you'll never know until you get back to the vehicle, and you're like, oh my gosh, that cam slipped, and it was resting on my peep, and now it's been like rubbing against my peep fibers, and now like half of them are frayed. Crap.
Right.
You never would have known because the bow is behind you. So I always recommend, if you're going to put it in a backpack, get one of those neoprene cam and string covers first. And then put it on the backpack.
Gotcha. That's a great tip. Huh. That's really cool. So on the note of, you know, so say that there's, so we've covered the guys who are putting their bows away for the next several months. On the note, if you're the guy who likes to tinker this time of year, I'm always curious, when it comes to building out like an archery setup for hunting, we'll say, is there anything that guys should really focus on? Like, if I'm going to splurge on my build, I'm going to splurge here.
So the first thing I would tell somebody to do is to get better at shooting. That is the number one. Like, it is the number one. And I know I'm biased as a shop owner, and I want to have more people shooting in my store and shooting leagues. But there's five or six guys that are brand new to our league this year, and we get about 60 shooters a year. In our league, it's pretty sizable. We get about five or six new people a year. All five of those guys came in here and we're shooting a Vegas score, so it's 300 round. And they started off shooting like 240s, 250s, 260s. In the first 5 weeks, those guys are already shooting in the 280s. They gain 20 points on a Vegas face. And if you think about it, a Vegas 9 ring is about 3 inches. Okay. Well, 3 inches in our backyard, we're like, heck yeah, man. I'm king of the mountain. Well, oh, 6-inch pie plate to kill a deer, blah, blah, 3 inches. You go on a Vegas face and you realize that, like, you're shooting the 250s out of 300. That's embarrassing. You don't want to be the 250 guy out of 3. You got a dude over here shooting the exact same. He's shooting a bow hunter bow and arrows, normal arrows, and he's shooting a 290. You're like, man, I'm 40 points worse than this guy. I'm not going to be 40 points worse than this guy. That's stupid. So now you learn to shoot better. Because better equipment doesn't do you any good if you're not going to get better. It doesn't. Mm-hmm. It does not do you any better if you're not going to splurge on it. If you're going to splurge, put the time to get better with it too. Same thing with a flagship boat. When guys are like, oh, I have a, like you said, I have a Mission Riot. I want to upgrade to a $1,000, $1,200 boat. Are you going to shoot anymore? Nah, I'm probably going to still shoot. Okay, then it's stupid. It's pointless.
Yep.
Because if you're not going to put the time in to invest into that, then why are you upgrading? That doesn't make any sense. Because it's not going to improve your accuracy. No equipment increases accuracy. You increase accuracy.
Yep.
So I always tell people, you just got to shoot more. That's the first and foremost thing. Shooting league, shooting paper, as much as it's terrible, it really shows up in the woods. It shows. I actually argue that shooting spots under pressure shows up more in the tree stand than shooting 3D course with your buddies, or even shooting 3D course for competition. I think shooting spots and that high pressure, going brain dead moment actually does more benefit for you when you are freaking out 20 feet up a tree than shooting a 3D course with your buddies. I really believe that. I strongly believe that. But if, you know, once you do some more shooting and you get involved with it, and you really, you know, increase your accuracy and your level, the two things I recommend are your rest and your release. You'd be amazed at how much a quality rest can really increase your accuracy and your forgiveness. Nothing wrong with a whisker biscuit. There's nothing wrong with an inexpensive drop away, but there are just things that are built better. I'm a big Hamsky guy, big Hamsky limb driven guy. But a Q80 HDX is probably the most simple, higher middle of the road, you know, hunting rest out there. And shoot anything. You shoot a 27, a 25, 23, all the hunting arrow diameters, whatever. It's bomb proof, lifetime warranty, made in Virginia, everything. For like $140, you'll see a massive improvement over, say, a whisker biscuit or a really cheap drop away. Same thing with a Hamsky. You don't have to buy a $300 rest. $150 will put you in a really good spot. Same thing with the release. I see so many people are like, I have a release, or I got a release from my uncle or whatever. And it's 20 years old. The trigger's not accurate. It's not adjustable. Spending $70 on an adjustable release, you know, you can adjust the length, you can adjust the trigger tension, the trigger travel. We're talking index releases here. Spending $150 on a good thumb button. Like, I like Hotshot releases. They make a really couple really good thumb button releases. That will note, you'll notice a crisper release. Your brain works with it better. If you have this release that, like, you can, and everybody's got it. You have a release where you can squeeze and all of a sudden you feel like you hit a click and like it stops moving. That's when your brain knows it's about to go off, and that's when you panic. If you have a trigger, you're just squeezing, all of a sudden the bow just goes off. That's what you want, and you're not going to get that out of a $30 release. It's just not going to happen. So those two things, if you know, once you put the time in to actually improve your skill, those two things will drastically improve, or drastically assist in taking you take the next step in your accuracy and just confidence in shooting overall.
That's really good to know. You know, I've seen a lot of guys, you know, talk about like, well, I switched to this release, but I will only use this one for target. I won't hunt with it. I won't do X, Y, Z. Do you use a thumb button for hunting as well?
So I used to be that guy that was like, nah, target is one totally different thing and hunting is its own thing. And then one day my buddy, who is not a target archer, he's just strictly a hunter, was like, why do you do that? Why do you change? Because you got to move your peep, and now you got to resight in, and now you got to do all these things to fix to go from one release to the other. And I'm like, you know, you're right. Why am I changing? And so I only like 2 or 3 years ago did I start going to a thumb button for everything. And did it change my outlook on life? Because I would go, because hunting season, you know, goes into December. But, you know, but spot season, my indoor season started in December. So I had this problem every single year. Oh no, do I keep shooting my index for hunting? And then, you know, how am I going to get on my practice in with my thumb button? To heck with it. It doesn't matter anymore. I have the exact same release for everything. So, and I don't care. I could easily shoot target with an index release. It'd be kind of foreign for me right now to start because I haven't done it in a couple of years, but you could shoot one thing for everything. And most guys do. But yeah, I thought I was really clever doing the two thing, keeping my brain separate. And I can tell you in hindsight, I would not recommend it at all.
Is there a reason that you prefer the handheld over the index?
I just hate having stuff stuck to my wrist. There's a lot of really good index style releases, but also I just find that I just get a much more consistent anchor, a much more cleaner release shooting a handheld style release. Mm-hmm. And I've shot a bunch of them over the years. I've shot hinges, I've shot thumb buttons, I've shot Hotshot, Scott, B3, a lot of really good companies make a lot of really good stuff. And I just found that my scores, my consistency, and then also because I self-film everything, I can have my thumb button clipped onto my D-loop, and then I can move my camera without having to have to worry about the release whacking my camera arm or making a noise or something like that.
Sure, making noise, yeah.
Yeah, which you wouldn't, I know most people don't film their hunts, but that's just something, you know. And then also I would be climbing with, I used to helm with a climber, and I would put my release on the ground so I didn't drop it out of the tree. And then I would rotate mm-hmm. it around to the back of my hand to climb. So that way it wouldn't, I don't have to worry about that anymore now. Now I just put everything in my pocket and zip everything up. And when I get up there, I just pull it out. I have a little wrist lanyard that I'll put it on sometimes, but most of the time I just clip it onto the D loop and it's ready when I'm ready.
Sure. Yeah, dude, the number of times that I have just absolutely cracked a metal ladder while climbing up that, first light with my wrist strap, even when it's been on either way, you just, sometimes you're in a hurry, just forget about it and you go up and just ping.
My least favorite is when it would whack me on the back of the knuckle. Like I'd be going to grab something. Oh my gosh. And I just went, whoa, pow. Oh, right on the back of the hand. Oh my gosh. I had a Scott Little Goose or Little Goose, however you say it. And that head caught me right on the top of my right middle finger knuckle. And I was stung. Like I couldn't operate this hand for like a good 10 minutes. It caught me right on a nerve somehow. And I was like, this is stupid. I'm not doing this again. This is dumb. So then I just started climbing without putting it on. But then I'm like holding it up into my chest to put it on so I don't drop it out of the tree. It's like, I was like, I'm not doing this anymore.
Yeah. So you mentioned shooting spots and stuff like that a little bit. Are there any drills that the guys who are shooting or particularly guys who might not have, you mentioned there, like if you have a league nearby, get yourself involved with that, shoot some spots and, shoot with people around you. So you've got that pressure situation. If you're somebody who doesn't have a shop nearby or you're just shooting at home, what are some drills that guys should really be doing right now?
So or in the off season? Yeah. So a lot of people have a basement or a garage. And if your wife or girlfriend or whoever you live with will let you do it. I recommend going, the company 30-06 makes 10-yard targets. They take a Vegas face and they scale it down to 10 yards and it fits on a normal. So it's like if you were standing at 20 yards, this is how far the target would look from you, but you're only standing at 10 yards. And most people's garages, if you don't have a car in it, are about, 15 foot, right? 15, 20 foot across. So one of these little 10 yard Vegas faces, you can stick it to a normal block target or a normal bag target and you can shoot in your garage. You can shoot in your basement, right? Heck, you could even, if you have a spare room in your house, you can only shoot, 12 feet across. Doesn't matter. It's perfect. That is actually a really, really useful tool to shoot when it's 10 degrees outside like it is in Pennsylvania right now. If you don't have a shop, you can get 100-pack of those things. They come in like a big post-it note. You just rip them off for like $20. And I find it's just a really good exercise just practicing with something like that inside. Of course, if your home situation will allow you to do that, either a garage or basement or something. That's a big deal. You can do something even as simple as blank bailing, which is just continuously working your muscles at like 3 feet, right? There's no chance of missing the target. You're not really trying to aim at anything. But it's, again, your muscles don't get better unless you're exercising them and you're working on them. And your brain won't comprehend what you're trying to do unless you're doing it, all the time. So, I've done the whole try the rubber bands and, the exercise thing, but it's just not the same. It's just, I've tried holding an 8-pound dumbbell in my hand and pulling back a rubber band, but it's just not the same because you're doing the muscle side at least. And that's a good thing anyway. But then you have the whole mental side where you're trying to put a little glowing dot on what you're trying to hit and squeezing the trigger while telling your brain, don't panic at the same time. So if you can at any time, once a week, once every 2 weeks, pull out the bow and do, like I said, with the little Vegas faces, or even if it's just blank bailing, don't close your eyes. That's what blank bailing is supposed to be. You're not doing that. Make sure you're going to hit your target a few feet away. But at least if you have that opportunity, I don't even care if it's sitting down. Like I do the Vegas faces in my own house, but my basement's only so tall and I'm 6'4". So I can't stand up in my basement. So I have a 5-gallon bucket or a camp chair and I sit down like I'm in a turkey blind and I shoot Vegas faces while sitting down. It's not the same as when I'm actually competing, but at least it's getting my muscles activated and my brain thinking with my muscles at the same time. Doing that just keeps you involved. You know, it's just like any other sport. You know, you're not going to get better at it or maintain a level of performance if you don't continuously exercise it throughout the course of a year.
Right. Absolutely. You touched on it briefly there. A bow hunter's least favorite words that are target panic. If guys out there are struggling with this, I'm assuming someone like you who's flung a few arrows in their time, you've probably dealt with and worked through this. What advice do you have for guys who are maybe dealing with a little bit of that? They're trying to, you know, get clear of for next season.
Yeah. So target panic, again, just like what I was saying, is there's two parts to archery. There's the brain and there's the physical. And the brain will win every single time. The brain will win. The brain wins. You can't. Yeah, it's just you're in your own head. And a lot of guys say that blank bailing is the way to get rid of target panic. And I actually don't agree with that because what blank bailing is supposed to be is you're standing stupid close to the target and you just pull back and close your eyes and squeeze. Well, the brain is going to win. It's not the physical. We have no problem squeezing the trigger. We have no problem. Mm-hmm. It's telling our brain, stop. Like to get our brain comfortable with the idea of putting a pin somewhere and you don't have to shoot. Now, I've seen this on TV shows before, and I would not recommend it because accidents happen. But I've seen guys on YouTube and television, an animal will come in. They have no intention of shooting, but they still draw back on it and point their pin at it and follow it. It's a live target, right? Do not recommend it because what if your D-loop breaks, you accidentally touch the release, and now you've shot an animal that you're not supposed to be shooting, okay? So I don't recommend it, but I've seen it done. But how do we do that? How do we simulate that type of situation in an area where there's no live animal to shoot at? And the only way you can do it is drawing back on things that give you target panic and not shooting. So I'm working with a young man right now in my store. I say young man, he's in his early 20s. So I guess he's almost my age, but I got 10 years on him. but he's really struggling with target panic with anything. 3D target, black spot, a yellow Vegas spot. And his brain is just pin hits target, boom, send the bow, shoot it. That's what his brain is telling him to do. So I'm like, hey, we're going to work on putting the pin on. He's shooting a handheld, wrapping our thumb around the barrel and just sitting. We're just going to work on that. And the first time he did it, I watched him. He wrapped his thumb, like he put his size saw and put his pin on target. He wrapped his thumb, boom, went. He shot. Because his brain literally could not handle the concept of pins in the center and we can't shoot. Like his, so we're working on right now, coming back to full draw, holding pin in the center, wrapping our thumb around the barrel, or if you're using index, wrap your index finger around and just sitting there and just watching your pin go up and down and bounce around. And when you start to get really shaky, just let down. Okay. Let the blood flow back a little bit. 10, 15 seconds later, draw back again. Put the pin on the center of the target, wrap your thumb around the trigger, index finger on the trigger, whatever, watch the pin float and just sit there. And you're training your brain to say, it's okay to be here and nothing happens. Because I know so many guys that have gut shot animals or so many guys that have not been able to perform a shot on an animal because their brain tells them in the backyard, when we draw back, we shoot. That's what we all do that. No one lets down in their backyard.
Yeah.
There's nothing on the line. But if you need to let down on an animal and you've never let down before, your brain won't let you do it. And you'll punch it right in the guts. You'll set it over its back. You'll be sitting there shaking. Doesn't matter. Your brain will win. But if you train yourself, my pin can sit here, but I can't shoot yet. I'm going to let down now. And you let down, you make it part of your routine and part of the abilities. Then you all of a sudden you're starting to get a hold on target panic. You're starting to break the habit where I don't have to shoot if I don't want to, because that's what target panic is. Target panic is if I don't shoot, the world's going to catch on fire. And that's, it couldn't be further from the truth. And you have to train your brain to know the exact opposite. And that's very, very difficult. It's way easier said than done.
Yeah. Dude, that's such a good point too. Cause like you're right. Nobody, yeah. If I'm going to take 20 minutes to set everything up, I'm going to go in the backyard, I'm going to set my block up, I'm going to, you know, do all this stuff or whatever. Why would I not fling an arrow? You know what I mean? That seems counterintuitive. Yeah. I should be able to, yeah. I should be, you know, Joel Turner just controlling my shot process and like squeezing through and like, cause I battled with that when I was dealing with it, where I got so focused on my damn index finger and my trigger and how I was doing things and where the trigger was on my finger and how much tension I was putting in, all that sort of stuff. But like, issue was my eyes. You know what I mean? It was as soon as that pin gets where I want it to be, I would start dropping in or I would freak out or I would punch and then everything just went to hell. But yeah, man, figuring out the mental side of things is, it's the hardest part. And especially having the wherewithal to know that I don't have to shoot an arrow. Like for a while there, when I was working through it, when I finally did get to the point of like realizing that my issue was seeing my pin on the target, like I would just draw back with no arrow. Cause I knew that if I didn't, like I needed a consequence that like, hey, if I punch this trigger, I'm going to trash my bow and I'm going to be out a lot of money and have to go to the shop. So don't be an idiot here. And let's just force
yourself.
That's
a little extreme for me. Drawing back a bow without an arrow. That's intense. That's like,
yeah, it was stupid.
That's some next level stuff right there. Yeah. But a prime example. So I had target panic for years. I mean, years. Mm-hmm. I would fight with it. And right now, knock on wood, I'm in a really good spot with how I shoot. It's really, really comfortable. But the two deer that I shot this year, I drew long before I knew I was going to shoot. And I always would see that in hunting shows, you know, deer's coming in and a guy draws back and he's waiting. And it's like, man, well, when I draw back, I shoot. How is he waiting? Well, now I realize that he's drawing back and he's actually waiting. He's not following that deer. He's waiting for that deer to get to that window. And so the buck that I shot this year in Pennsylvania, you can watch the footage. I know why I'm not shooting him where he's standing when I drew back, and I'm waiting for him to get into my window. As soon as he gets to my window, start squeezing, arrow goes off. And it's funny, when I watch myself shoot at a target on film and I watch how I shot that deer, they look identical. Like the shots look identical. My hand movements are identical. The bow movement's identical. And I'm swinging up a saddle 20 feet in the tree. So that was actually the coolest part. It wasn't the fact that I shot the deer. The coolest part to me was that I've trained my brain that whether I'm shooting at a paper, a climate controlled indoors, or that deer outside, that shot looked identical. It was really cool. Right. I was like, yes, I finally made it. And then the buck that I shot in Ohio this year, I drew on him, but I knew I wasn't going to shoot him yet because he was facing me. But I put my pin on where I would have shot him if I needed to. And I just followed him. And I was like, he's still not broadside, still not broadside, still not. Now he's broadside. Rant. Squeezed him, drilled him, watched him fall over. Because I was able to put my pin where it needed to be and wait for him to turn to be the target where I want that pin to go. The pin's not, it's not there yet. The pin's there, but he's not. So unlike the bag target in the backyard where you're going to pin meet the target, I need the target to meet the pin. And as soon as he met that pin, I lasered him and he fell over in 50 yards. So those kind of things have taken me like 20 years of work to get there. But it's, again, it's all the mental side. It's not the blank bailing doesn't do it. The closing your eyes and all that sort of stuff. We have no problems squeezing the trigger. It's telling our brain to not panic and that it's okay to not shoot. Yeah. The whole letting down in the backyard thing, that's no one lets down in their backyard. But if you learn to do it, you'll learn to do it other places too.
Right. Right. That's such a good tip, man. Last archery question for you here. If you were to build the perfect all-around hunting arrow, how would you build it?
Oh boy! Here goes the fanboys. I live in the bow shop world, I respectfully say I live in reality, which is where guys come into the store and they want a hunting arrow that's going to work. Okay, so not we go online and do 9 hours worth of research and learn about 650 grains and 20% FOC and all that nonsense. So most of the arrows that I sell between a 400 spine and a 300 spine. You know, so 400, 340, and 300. Most of what I sell is between 400 and 500 grains. That's just where those arrows live. Normal insert, 100 grain point. So for me, I want to cut an arrow to be at or up to either at or an inch over a person's draw length with the right spine. I prefer standard diameter arrows because they're really easy to find. I view arrow building from the concept of, if I'm in a pinch and I need help, where can I get help right now? Mm-hmm. So it's really cool to build a very expensive arrow or an arrow from a company that's direct to consumer. There's nothing wrong with that. But I've seen it all. Guy, it gets out of his truck, opens the tailgate, pulls his bow out of the case, pulls the quiver out of the case, closes the case, picks the bow up, slams the tailgate, and he shears six arrows off because he forgot to pick up his quiver. He shears six arrows off at the bed of his tailgate. Well, if he's shooting some bougie, direct-to-consumer, you know, hand-fletched with whatever, he's out the creek without a paddle. I mean, he's now got to go order arrows, cut, insert. He could be out a week or 2 weeks. Imagine that happens November 1st. Or he could be shooting some Gold Tip XT hunters, and he can walk into my store, and 15 minutes later, I can have them cut, insert it, and he's out the door. Right? So from my perspective as a bow shop owner, if an accident's going to happen, I want to make sure that I can rectify it very quickly. I want a part that's, you know, a part of the system that's reliable. So, you know, a standard diameter arrow, you can pretty much find anywhere. Heck, you can find them at Walmart, for Pete's sake. And most of the time, you know, they're going to have an arrow or big box store or something or your local bow shop. And then I like the standard inserts because they're always going to be in stock. And then I like shooting 125 grain broadhead. I think anybody could benefit from shooting 125 grain broadhead, and everybody stocks them. 100, 125. They're very there. And then I would choose a reliable fixed blade from any of the manufacturers. My number one's Magnus. They make a whole bunch of different great fixed blade heads. Wasp makes some good ones. I'm very interested in that, in Rec, which is out of Michigan. That's a newer company that hit the market. They make some interesting broadheads.
Never heard of them.
They have a little FX4. Slick Trick makes some great fixed blade broadheads, and so does Grim Reaper in their Hades lineup. You pick any of those, you'll find them in any big box store, any bow shop around the country, and you've got yourself an arrow that's ready to roll. And again, depending on your draw length and poundage, it's going to be between 400 and 500 grains. My arrows live around 460 to 480, depending on how much the tube weighs. I'm shooting a Gold Tip. I'm shooting Ultra arrows right now, which are a little bit heavier in GPI. Not by much, but enough. So they're about 470, 475. And I blow through whitetails just fine. I set up people that go hunt elk here in Pennsylvania. I set up people that go hunt elk out west. And if they want a little bit heavier, you know, 150 up front, maybe they want something like an Eastern Axis or a Gold Tip Kinetic Chaos. That's the tube is heavier and it's a smaller diameter. Cool. We can do that too. But most of the stuff that I work on and really try to get people to work with are things that are easy to tune, good trajectory, great penetration out of a good fixed blade head. And it just keeps it simple. It really keeps it easy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, totally, man. That's you almost described my exact arrow setup because I was when I bought the bow, I was like, all right, well, I need new arrows now. Shit, I just spent a bunch of money on this bow. I don't really want to shell out another couple hundred for arrows now, especially when I'm somebody who was like, I was on the tail end of my target panic there. I was like, if I shoot a $40 arrow over the block into that cornfield, I'm going to be kind of pissed. So,
yeah.
Yeah, that's a great tip that, I don't know. I feel like we're still kind of seeing the repercussions from like COVID and everybody working from home and being home and having that extra money in their pocket to put towards hobbies and stuff. And guys just with a little too much time and resources on their hand that they just couldn't help themselves but tinker and like, and you know, try messing with stuff. But no, that's really good to know, man.
Yeah, it's easy to get into a tinkering hole and very difficult to get your way out of it. But I think there is enough desire again. I think it's coming back. I think what you described with COVID is 100% correct. But I think it's coming back to people like, man, those are like 2 years of my life I'm not going to get back. You know, can I just go back to just hunting? Like, I would much rather worry about shooting than is my arrow flying perfectly, my bear shaft not tuning everything. I think people are just like, can I just keep it simple and kill stuff Yes, you can. You really can. It's easy, and it's not that expensive to do it.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. There's nothing wrong with a $9 arrow shaft. That's that's for sure.
Amen. Or even less. Well,
before we were, exactly. Before we wrap up here, man, we haven't touched on Huntworth a whole lot here, and I wanted to just pick your brain here real quick before we wrap up. Is there any new and exciting stuff coming down the pipe from Huntworth that we can that we should have our eyes peeled for this year?
Yeah, I mean, there's always cool stuff that we're definitely working on every single year. There's definitely some new stuff coming for 2025 I'm very excited about, and if I told you, I'd have to kill you. But no, there's definitely some exciting stuff for 2025 for Huntworth that, you know, Huntworth as a brand has grown a lot. You know, this is our 25th year in business, and we've been out of Pittsburgh ever since. It's been owned by a husband and wife the whole time. There's no private slush funds and trust equity. I mean, there's nothing. It's literally just a family owned and operated business. Most of the employees came from small Pennsylvania schools. I came from Penn State, Art Institute of Pittsburgh, Kent State out in Ohio, Slippery Rock, Clarion University. A lot of these really small town blue collar people, and they work for Huntworth. It's a really cool family operated business. And so I'm very proud to be a part of that. But part of that is also really unique to see the innovation that comes out of Huntworth. So you know, we just launched Vertec last year in August. Lots of cool stuff this year for 2025 for Whitetail and other things, which is cool. And then we're, of course, always looking to expand on our Heat Boost, which is our graphene, you know, yarn that we infuse into knit into fabrics, rather. It's not battery operated, but it's just absorbing more body heat and sends it back to you. So garments can be thinner and more flexible. And just we just try to make it better for everybody while not driving costs through the roof. You know, since we're not some multi-billion dollar company who have like 400 television shows to feed and this person and that person, we're able to make waterproof garments and windproof garments in our own camo patterns, and it costs a fraction of what everybody else is doing. It's just like, look at all the stuff you get for a portion of the cost that you would pay for the other big companies. And being able to support a, I call them a mom and pop. It drives them nuts when I say that, but I view it that way. I view them as a family owned mom and pop business. And who doesn't love supporting that? I mean, I think we all would agree that we would rather support that than Jeff Bezos or Mark Zuckerberg, or so, you know, they have their money, but the small town people who've made a business of themselves for the past 25 years in the Steel City, you know, in the Rust Belt of America, it's really cool. And so, yeah, Huntworth is doing great. We had a great year for 2024. Really looking forward to what we get to do for 2025. We'll have some stuff coming out around turkey season. We'll have some stuff coming out around the summer and fall. So, yeah, definitely keep your eyes peeled out for that as we look to continue to grow.
Hell yeah. Love it, man. Yeah, I can't wait. And I mean, I've told you this. We were texting throughout the hunting season and stuff. That stuff, it didn't matter what I had on, man. I was blown away by how warm I was this entire season. Like, I could not believe it. As a guy who switched to Huntworth from First Light stuff, I was so much warmer. And the number of layers that I had to factor in when I was planning a sit and looking at the weather and everything, it was the most, I mean, I wore, honestly, well, it's kind of gross, but I wore like the same base layers and the same, like, you know, that Grayling hoodie that you've got on. Like, dude, I wore the hell out of that stuff all through November. And if I got cold, I'd throw the vest on or I'd throw a jacket on over top of it. But man, I was the warmest I've been and the driest I've been throughout an entire hunting season, all because of Huntworth. So
we get that all the time.
You have to check this out.
Yeah, we get that all the time. They're like, wow, I'm like warm. It's like, yeah, you're warm. Mm-hmm.
It's weird.
Like, I'm dry. I'm windproof. Like, I don't feel anything. It's great. I'm like, yeah, welcome to the club. Like, this is what we bring. What Huntworth brings to the market is what people wish they could, you know, they think is only available in like your top end brands. It's not. Like, windproof and waterproofing is not coveted technology. It's available to the universe. So we don't have to pay Gore-Tex an arm and a leg to, you know, put their sticker on our windproofing and waterproofing because it's not a patent anymore. So we have the exact same stuff at a half, two-thirds the price or whatever in our own camo patterns. I think that's actually the coolest part. I know most people don't get wound up about the camo patterns, but all of our camo patterns are made in-house by our design team. and really piloted mm-hmm. by one guy, Mike. I give Mike huge props. The dude thinks camo. I think hunting, he thinks camo. It's crazy. Mm-hmm. But they're all completely designed by him and our design team in-house. And so everything is done proprietary. We're not leasing somebody else's camo. We're not outsourcing anything. It is all R&D and designed from the ground up in Pittsburgh by our team. So it's a really cool experience to have that level of, you know, everybody wants to have that level of connection to the, you know, the manufacturing process and the R&D process. And we have that. There's no disconnect. Yeah. Every single thing that we do is deliberate, and it doesn't happen without us saying it's going to happen.
Mm-hmm. Totally, man. And I mean, and all the patterns are freaking legit, like lights out and the stuff like,
legit.
Dude, the number of times that I had deer look straight at me this year and then like give you that look, kind of like head bob a little bit and then just keep on walking. I mean, I had I had two bucks at 30 yards or 40 yards or something like that. I was in the middle of an open field, crouched down just with my bow in front of my face, and they looked at me and went right back to eating. Knew something was up. The only reason they busted was because they heard me when I was trying to stalk them while they were behind a tree, and that was it. Yeah, like, you know what I mean? It's I'd much rather have the issue be that than they're picking me off, you know, like crazy. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, especially for, say, if you're somebody who, you know, I was running the Tarnin pattern this year. And I mean, especially like in marshy stuff, I was really, really happy with that. You've got cattails or tall grass or, you know, some more sparse trees that, you know, there's a lot of light behind them. Man, I was absolutely blown away. Plus the solids too, dude. The solids are awesome.
We're hoping to continue to expand on that. We're working on some different ideas, of course, always for that. You know, the solids are big for the out western guys, which we're not really known for the out western, but there is a definite push for the lifestyle side. So we'll see how that continues to expand. Yeah.
Yeah, totally, man. Do you have a favorite garment that folks listening should definitely add to their kit?
I am a huge fan of the Grayling hoodie, which I'm wearing currently in the ash brown. We sell it in all three patterns as well, Tartan, Disruption, and Vertec. This thing gets worn all the time. I would say, though, the thing that I use and abuse the most are the Elkins bibs. The Elkins bibs are windproof, DWR treated. They have the two-way leg zip, so I unzip them from the hip to the knee when I'm walking in. Because they're windproof, I can, but very lightly insulated, I can wear them, you know, in the 50 degree weather over a light base layer and be okay. But then if it gets down to the 30s, just pack on some layers underneath, get a good thermal in there, Grayling hoodie, base layer, maybe a vest and the jacket, I'm golden, good to go. So I'll wear those elk and shoot from here in Pennsylvania, in particular from October 1st to almost the end of November. I mean, it's just, it's like the meat and potatoes of my bow season is in those bibs. And, I think I have two pairs, and one's like my beat 'em up, you know, go on deer drives pair, and the other one's like the nice ones that I can climb in and haven't destroyed yet. So yeah, the Elkins entire lineup, the jacket, bibs, pants, vest, classic bow hunting stuff. But the bibs in particular for me are huge.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, dude. And that, I mean, they're such a low bulk bib too. Correct. And like you said, the windproofing on them is phenomenal. So you can unzip on your hike. And like, dude, I had days that I was hiking like a mile and a half in, trudging through this marsh, and I wouldn't overheat. You know what I mean? It was perfect. But then I'd get in the tree, zip those suckers up. And
zip them up, baby. Yeah.
Yeah.
Snug as a bug.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, dude, I don't want to keep you too much longer here. I know it's past 1 p.m. now in your neck of the woods, and you're kind of in the middle of your work day. So, I'm going to let you get back to that. But, dude, this has been fantastic, and I really appreciate your time and just all the knowledge that you've shared with us here today. Where can folks go to find you and the awesome content that you're putting out through Average Jack?
Yeah, you can find Huntworth, of course, on social media, Facebook, Instagram. You can always go to huntworthgear.com and check us out over there, the products we have to offer. Of course, you can always find Average Jack Archery Pro Shop and Range on Facebook and Instagram. My big dumb face is everywhere. And if you are in central Pennsylvania or in the Northeast in general and you need to have a new bow shop or just want to come check us out, we're at 21 North Front Street in Phillipsburg, PA, about a half-hour drive from Penn State University. You're welcome to come down and check out all the things you have to offer, shoot the breeze, get stuff tuned up, work on, shoot in the range, whatever you want to do.
Love it, man. That's excellent. Well, dude, I'm going to let you get back to it. I really appreciate your time, and I'm sure I'll talk to you soon here as we start leading up to turkey season.
Absolutely, man. I appreciate you having me on.
That's all for this week's episode. Thank you so much for tuning in. If you liked this episode, please be sure to subscribe to this podcast wherever you get your podcasts. And while you're at it, if you could leave me a 5-star review, I would appreciate that a ton. You can also follow along with my outdoor adventures on Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube at the Wisconsin Sportsman Pod. That's also the best way to get a hold of me to suggest topics, guests, or questions you'd like me to explore in this show. Big thanks to our awesome partners XOP, Onyx, and Huntworth. Please go support the brands and support this show. And if you're looking for more awesome outdoor content, go check out thesportsmansempire.com, where you'll find a ton of other outdoor podcasts. And until next time, make sure you make the time to get outside and enjoy the incredible natural resources that are ours as Wisconsin sportsmen.
I saw this app.
I got a hit.
In the new limited series, DTF St. Louis, Jason Bateman, David Harbour, and Linda Cardellini star as three suburbanites who spice up their love lives.
Wow.
Don't miss the new HBO original limited series, DTF St. Louis, premiering March 1st on HBO Max.
You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.